If, half dead of exhaustion and a bilious fever, Madison could convince his state to ratify, New York would be forced to follow suit or lose influence. Which was why Hamilton's strategy in the assembly was to delay, 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 and hope we were saved by Virginia. In the meantime, Peggy said, let's go shopping. Which was how, a few days later, we found ourselves coming home from the dressmaker on Market Street when riders came galloping through in a cloud of dust, shouting, Virginia has ratified! Virginia has ratified! Peggy and I ran almost the whole way home, where my brothers, Johnny and Jeremiah, grown men now, popped the corks on bottles of Papa's best sparkling wine in the main hall under the chandelier. I worried it was ill luck to celebrate prematurely, but inside, some part of me began to believe. Peggy grabbed a glass and raised it. To Virginia! To Virginia, I agreed, laughing, never realizing it would be the last time I ever had reason to celebrate that accursed state. In anticipation of our own state's ratification, the celebrations continued in New York City. Bricklayers and wig makers rallied on Broadway with colorful ribbons, banners, and flags. Bakers marched a giant federal loaf of bread down the street. Brewers rolled a massive cask of ale. Sailmakers carried a 20-foot flag depicting my husband with a laurel leaf and his constitution. And when New York finally ratified, Hamilton was so celebrated that, as fireworks lit the skyline under a bright moon, the people of Manhattan suggested the city be renamed Hamiltoniana. At last, the honors and glory my husband craved. The legacy he'd made for a name he wasn't deemed fit to carry. The base-born orphan from Nevis, who might have toiled in poverty and obscurity if God hadn't bestowed upon him a giant intellect and ambition to match. And the honors were no more than his due. He'd done it. He'd vanquished Governor Clinton and all our anti-federalist foes. More than that, he'd battled back the forces of ignorance and anarchy with his pen and the power of his ideas. He was, at that time perhaps more than any other, my conquering hero. Like the son of an ancient god who'd driven that chariot of the sun after all. And when we were finally reunited, I wrapped my arms around his neck and teased, the people love you, but remember, thou art but mortal. It's what the old Romans whispered to conquering heroes, so that they might never fall victim to hubris. And Alexander laughed. So you did read those books I gave you? Not well enough. Because if I'd studied the ancient stories, I'd have known that the same people who could lift a hero and his family out of obscurity could also tear them to pieces. March 1789, New York City. We had a new constitution, a new government, and a new baby. It was everything for which we'd worked for so long. And then, to make my happiness complete, my sister returned home from London for what she promised this time would be a long visit. Oh, Angelica. Her dark hair, worn in a chignon beneath her fashionably plumed bonnet, smelled of rose water. Cinched beneath her bosoms, her muslin gown was perhaps more fitting for the boudoir than the docks of New York. I felt drab and shabby in comparison, but couldn't get enough of looking at her. We embraced again and again as her servants carried her boxes into her new dwelling. You should stay with us, I said again, even though I knew she'd insisted Hamilton rent for her very handsome lodgings nearby, so as not to burden us. As if having my sister at my side could ever be a burden. Oh, my sweet, generous Betsy, Angelica said, kissing my nose, as if she still thought of me as her baby sister. No doubt you'd give up your bed to make room for me, but where would the servants sleep? In London, she was accustomed to a great many servants and a great many rooms. No doubt our narrow little abode with 5 children underfoot and chickens in the yard would scarcely suit. I suppose we would have trouble stowing your luggage.
I brought only 8 trunks, Angelica said, laughing. How else was I to carry gifts for your cherubs?
At the prospect of gifts, my children danced around their Aunt Angelica excitedly. I was only sorry that their cousins, safely stashed in the best European schools, hadn't made the journey with their mother. But we consoled ourselves with Angelica's undivided attention, and already my head was full of plans for her visit. What's more, my husband seemed to bask in my happiness. Eyeing the mountain of my sister's luggage, Alexander teased,
"Given how little you've carried from Europe, sister, I worry you'll have nothing to wear."
Angelica laughed. "Well, I must tell you, brother, that in some parts of Europe, it is very much the fashion to go out in the state of nature." This comment made me gasp, which only encouraged her. "Mr. Jefferson told me that when we were in Paris together. He heard it from Mrs. John Adams. Oh, you have no idea the exalted and interesting people I met across the sea. But none could make up for your company. How I've missed you both. My dearest beloved sister and the great man she lured into our family." Preening at her praise, my husband fiddled with what appeared to be a broken latch on one of her apartment doors and promised to have someone out to repair it in the morning. Then, with regret, he said,
"Ladies, I console myself to know you can find ways to amuse yourselves while I'm gone. Alas, I must rush to an appointment."
"So soon?" I asked, not wishing to lose him again to his books and papers. "You've worked so hard, too hard."
"You both work too hard,"
Angelica said, grasping my hand in her soft, manicured, bejeweled fingers, as if horrified to find mine rough, dry, and reddened from scrubbing linens, sewing clothes, and keeping house alongside Jenny. "My dear Hamilton, my servants will prepare dinner for all of us. I'm going to take care of you, my darlings. You shall have a holiday when home. I insist that you dine with me tonight."
"Oh, please, Alexander."
I wanted nothing more than to be around the same table with the 2 people whose company I loved best in the world. But my husband sighed with regret.
"I'm afraid I'm to dine with some gentlemen at Francis Tavern."
"Invite them here," Angelica said, and a look of panic flittered over the faces of the servants who'd just emerged, half seasick, from the bowels of an ocean-going ship, and were not even settled into a new home in a new city. I couldn't think how they might be ready to entertain on a moment's notice. But that didn't stop my sister from making the offer. Nor did it discourage Alexander.
"How can I resist my 2 brunette charmers?"
With that, he kissed me, then grabbed his coat and embraced the children, making the older ones promise to behave while he was gone.
"Invite whoever you like,"
Angelica called after him when he made for the door. "The poor Baron and his dog are always in need of a good meal. And what about the Burrs? They're wonderfully droll."
"Not Burr,"
Alexander said sharply, just before bounding out. As we watched him disappear with the crowd on the street, I explained, "He's vexed with Colonel Burr for throwing in with the Anti-Federalists and accepting a job from Governor Clinton." Clinton, the man whose minions called my husband Tom Shit. Angelica leaned closer, keen for gossip. "And that's cause enough to prevent him from dining with the man." Only someone who hadn't lived through the recent hostilities could be surprised by this. "Not always. Sometimes I persuade him to turn the other cheek for the sake of my friendship with Theodosia, but I fear it a lost cause."
"Well, even so, you're recompensed to have a husband so handsome and of such merit and abilities. A husband who..."
Her voice caught, and she bit her lip.
"A husband who plainly loves you."
Tears sprung to her eyes. Tears.
and my heart nearly stopped in my chest, because I wasn't sure I'd ever seen Angelica cry before. Not even when we were children, lest rivals for leadership over our troop of blues think they had the advantage.
Oh, Angelica, why are you crying?
Because I'm so happy for you, of course.
She dabbed at her eyes with a perfumed kerchief. Then, as if she couldn't bear for me to see her this way, she retreated to the parlor. I followed, still alarmed, even though I ought to have been minding my children, whose shoes were clumping on the polished wooden floor as they ran circles around the empty dining room. And when we were alone, she confessed,
"My husband doesn't love me." I was sure I'd misheard.
Everyone loved Angelica.
"That can't be true."
"It is," she said, with a miserable shake of her head.
"Church admits it."
My mouth dropped open.
"Your husband could never be so cruel. He must have been drunk, half out of his mind."
"He was drunk," Angelica replied softly. "But I fear that only made it easier to tell the truth. That he loved me once, but not any longer."
In numb shock, I murmured, Is there
a woman?" she asked with a bitter laugh. "Look hard enough and there's always a woman. But he's not in love with someone else. That I could understand. That would make sense. But no. There are only three things my husband loves now. Money, gambling, and the politics of the British Parliament."
I could scarcely credit this.
We hadn't approved of Church to start with, but we'd all become affectionately attached to him. Even Mama, who'd once called him a macaroni.
"I'm sure he loves you and the children, Angelica, no matter what he says."
"Jack loves our little brood," Angelica admitted sheepishly, as if she'd wronged him. "I shouldn't have implied otherwise. His children delight him. But I inspire him to feel nothing."
A little sob escaped her, and her red, watery eyes met mine.
"Have I lost my beauty, my wit? Tell me, Betsy, what has changed about me that could make me so unlovable?"
The bleeding anguish in her gaze revealed a wound as plain as I'd seen in any hospital, and pity overtook me. My dazzling sister, who'd always been confident and strong and triumphant, had somehow been carved up and diminished by the man she married. And I was furious.
Setting my jaw, I told her the plain truth.
"You are more charming and beautiful than you've ever been."
Her smile was fleeting. "What a Schuyler you are. Always loyal. I don't feel beautiful, or charming, or even welcome in my husband's home."
She said the next more emphatically,
"Of course, England was never my home.
Perhaps by pleading to return to America, maybe that's what did it. I've been so homesick that I let my own misery drive away my husband's love. Do you know, well, you'll think me terribly wicked."
She wouldn't meet my eyes, as if afraid to tell me more, and I became even more distressed.
"Wicked? Our friends in Europe are more broad-minded about love than we are here. They taught me how to take vengeance on a neglectful husband. When I met our American ambassador to France, the widowed Mr. Jefferson, and he took a fancy to me, I encouraged him. For a moment, I was so scandalized I lost all power of speech.
Seeing my expression, my sister quickly added,
"Oh, it was only a flirtation. I'm not one of Mr. Jefferson's lovers. But I hoped, by encouraging such a tall, stately, important gentleman, that my own husband might, well, that Church might feel jealousy."
"Oh, Angelica," I breathed, bringing my hands to my face. Absently, she ran her fingers through the dust on the windowsill.
"Unfortunately, Church scarcely even noticed." "You should count yourself lucky your husband doesn't think you guilty of adultery."
"He wouldn't care if I were guilty of adultery.
She sighed, as if that were the worst part. I know this because at a card party someone jested that the Prince of Wales might choose me for a new mistress. And do you know what my husband said?
Swallowing, I hesitated to ask, for such jests caused duels.
Church quipped that it might help him politically, and that the next time he was losing a game of cards with the prince, he'd add me to the wager.
No, I cried, horrified. Obviously humiliated, a teary Angelica rushed to add,
Church was very drunk when he said that. He apologized, begged a thousand pardons. I shouldn't have told you, I feel so ugly and unwanted and lonely. Even in a crowd, I'm so alone.
Here she broke down sobbing, and I could do nothing but stand by, awkwardly stroking her back. This wasn't the way things were between us. She was the older sister, always comforting me, helping me when I skinned my knees and wiping my tears. It was a new world as I contemplated how to take care of the sister who'd taken care of me. After a moment, she bravely swiped at her eyes.
Well, romantic trouble isn't so terrible in the scheme of things, is it? Given my good fortune in comparison to others, I've no right to feel sorry for myself.
She smoothed the bodice of her gown, such that sunlight streaming into the airy windows made her rings glitter.
Scarcely a couple I knew in London made a match based on love. They marry for land and titles and are happy enough. Church and I have respect. At least, we had it. That's why, if I return to him, I must return as the Angelica he used to know.
I missed a breath.
If.
The word escaped my lips, but Angelica barely seemed to notice. If she returned to him.
Why, there couldn't be any choice about it, could there?
Divorce wasn't impossible, but it wasn't easy or desirable. Not for women like us. Not without adultery or some other provable cruelty, and even then, it was a scandal. Women sometimes lived apart from their husbands if they had means, if they had somewhere to go. But even then, their children could be taken from them.
I have to stay gone long enough for him to miss me, Angelica explained with a little shrug.
I realized that this was a new scheme, and it settled a knot into my stomach.
Long enough to convince myself there are people who still love me.
Because I feel as if no one else could possibly love me if my own husband doesn't.
That's how it was, wasn't it? A wife's purpose was to make her husband happy, to give him children and merit his love and esteem.
Even though Angelica had done that, people would fault her for the cracks in her marriage, especially if she let them show. I'd never before considered the unfairness and injustice in that. And in defiance of the very idea, I threw my arms around her.
Oh, but you are loved. We're going to remind you of it every day. I promise we'll never let you feel lonely here. Not for a moment.
I stayed at her side the rest of that afternoon as weary servants scurried back and forth to the market. When I finished nursing 10-month-old James and put the children down for a nap on Angelica's enormous canopied feather bed with its damask drapes and claw-shaped feet, I helped her rearrange furniture and spoke cheerfully, trying to raise her spirits. I asked about her children, about London, about any subject that would not tread too near her troubles. But my poor sister's spirits had been shattered to pieces. All those years ago, she'd put her faith in love, and now? When Alexander returned that night for dinner with his gentleman friends, I whispered, "Please compliment my sister's gown." Alexander arched a brow, as if he hoped some amusing game was afoot.
Hmm?
Clutching his arm with urgency, I leaned closer.
She's very much in need of kindness.
My husband cocked his other eyebrow only briefly before turning his charm on my sister like a cannonade, blasting her with compliments until, for just a moment, I imagined we were back in a Morristown ballroom, where he'd called her the divine Mrs. Carter. When Angelica's servants brought expensive port and custard-filled profiteroles purchased at the nearby patisserie, he conversed with her in French. I didn't know what he said, but whatever it was made her laugh with delight. And I was grateful. So very grateful. A little mesmerized, too, by the way Angelica managed to affect a mask of joy in the presence of her guests. While the Baron told jokes in his harsh, guttural accent, she fed his dog little tidbits, as if she didn't even mind the creature in her house. Not a trace of her misery slipped out as she poured wine and sang songs and insisted that we all play cards together despite the mixed company. She was, I realized, an extraordinary actress. And as the exhausted servants cleared away the dishes, I wondered how much of what I'd always taken for my sister's confidence and daring was a shield for vulnerability that I never knew was there. I'd always been too busy and curious about the world to dwell on insecurities, but I'd certainly felt myself to be less beguiling, less interesting than my sister's. So it was a revelation to learn that my bold, charming Angelica might harbor such feelings. Knowing this made me all the more affectionate and protective toward her. From behind the white lace of her sleeve and the fan of her cards, my sister asked, "How did you let the insouciant Colonel Burr become an anti-federalist?"
"Burr is worse than an anti-federalist," Alexander groused, slyly sliding his card onto the table while the Baron puffed at his pipe. "He's turned out to be an opportunist. Burr only decided to oppose the Constitution in order to curry favor with Governor Clinton, from whom he has now accepted a post."
Hoping to stave off what I knew would be a lengthy diatribe, I patted my husband's hand and grinned at him. "We won, Alexander. Clinton tried to stop you, but you got the Constitution passed and became a hero to the city. You even crushed Clinton's candidacy for the vice presidency. Isn't that enough?" Alexander turned on me like a lawyer at court, as if my sister were the judge.
"It will be enough when Clinton holds no influence anywhere or with anyone, including Burr."
"Oh, my dear brother," Angelica interrupted with a laugh, "you mustn't chide Betsy for elevated instincts. Unlike Machiavelli, she's far too saintly to adhere to the principle that once one makes an enemy of a man, one must not leave him alive to get revenge. At least, not politically alive. Betsy is too kind-hearted for that, whereas I have no such scruples. If Clinton got in your way, I approve of any and all measures to be rid of him, even if it means shunning Colonel Burr. It's a matter of loyalty, after all. Semper Fidelis."
"Church," Peggy ground out through clenched teeth, keeping her voice low so as not to wake her new baby in his cradle. "And to think we called him brother."
She had, praise God, come through her ordeal and given birth to a son, another Stephen. And the little boy was so healthy that a happy Peggy joined the rest of the family in New York City for the inauguration of our first president, George Washington. Unfortunately, I'd ruined Peggy's mood by telling her of Angelica's troubles. I'd hesitated to tell Peggy, but needed her discretion.
"You mustn't say anything, for Angelica's sake. I only revealed this because you must help me to divert the family from asking questions that our sister finds too painful to answer."
Blowing dark curls out of her eyes, Peggy speared me with a side glance.
"I'll try, but you know how Mama can be. She'll sniff out the trouble in a minute."
On Inauguration Day, all of Wall Street was a sea of straw hats, colorful parasols, and children hoisted aloft on shoulders, straining for a glimpse of the president. Banners danced in the early spring breeze, keeping time to the lively music made by minstrels on every corner. Troops marched in blue coats with red facings and gold embroideries,
cocked hats with white feathers and black spatterdashes buttoned close from the shoe to the knee. Scottish infantry marched in full Highland costume with bagpipes. And we, Hamiltons and Schuylers, crowded onto my upstairs balcony to watch the spectacle occurring just across the street at Federal Hall. The building had been recently renovated with elegant stone archways, white neoclassical marbled columns, and a majestic glass cupola. And as we gazed in admiration, the crowd went silent. The president emerged onto the outside gallery, and now, with several attendants, stood between two pillars in a dark brown coat, waistcoat, and breeches, with white silk stockings and plain silver buckles glinting on his shoes. The Secretary of the Senate held an open Bible upon a rich crimson cushion as the oath was administered. "It's regrettable that Mr. Church could not be here to share such a celebratory moment," Mama said, her too observant gaze upon Angelica.
"Look, Washington is raising his hand," Peggy exclaimed,
stepping between them as she patted her baby's back.
"He's so distinguished," Angelica said softly,
giving Peggy an appreciative glance.
"Like a statue or an old pagan god."
Alexander had persuaded George Washington that he was the only man who could hold the new government together as commander-in-chief, and certainly his dignified bearing inspired confidence. But I was struck by the strangest notion that Washington looked frightened, and I clutched at the pendant worn round my neck, as if, through the talisman of his hair clipping, I could lend strength to him. We could not, from our place, hear the words of the oath distinctly. But we did see him bow to kiss the Bible, his eyes closed as if in prayer. And my husband and my father closed their eyes, too, in relief or thanksgiving or both. This moment had been a long time in coming. Both of them had lost friends to the cause. All of us had sacrificed for it. And my lower lip trembled when someone from the crowd below shouted, "Long live George Washington, President of the United States!" The sentiment was punctuated by the boom of a cannon that frightened all our little ones. Mama ushered the children back into the house while the crowd roared its approval, and the deed was done. All that was left was to celebrate. But Angelica seemed reluctant to come out with us. Infected by the thrill of the day and my fear of leaving Mama and Angelica alone together, I insisted.
"I must show you a new invention on the streets. Artwork, painted on transparent canvas, to be illuminated behind in such a way as it brings the pictures alive."
Angelica smiled sadly.
"I saw such in France."
"You haven't seen the entire harbor illuminated with lamps and fireworks.
Besides, Hamilton is so looking forward to your company."
Angelica flicked a fond glance at my husband.
"Well, he is the hero of the hour."
My husband didn't deny it. Instead, he said, "And the hero is entitled to the spoils. Come out with me, my beautiful brunettes, and I shall be the envy of every man in the city." We laughed, thinking it quite a wonderful thing to be envied. In those heady, happy days, we'd not learned yet that envy is a poison to which none are immune.
Chapter 19. May 7th, 1789, New York City.
"It's going to be the most brilliant of entertainments," I said. "The inaugural ball is a celebration of all our hard work and sacrifice."
"Not for me. Not without my husband."
Angelica strolled to the window, staring out over the street at the passing carriages on the busy thoroughfare. "You'll say that I've gone to balls without him before, but that was different. I wasn't a cast-off wife to be pitied and scorned." The post had come without a letter from her husband or her children. She'd taken it hard, and I was determined to cheer her.
"No one will pity or scorn you," I said, though I suspected it to be a lie.
No one will even guess that anything is amiss.
She forced herself to smile.
Except for you, Betsy. You'll spend your evening fretting over me, and I would never wish to take away from your happiness when you're soon to be such a grand lady.
Looking down at my stained apron, I said, I'm hardly a grand lady.
Angelica also looked at my stained apron and made a face. You'd best transform yourself into one then, because everyone will look to you to set the style. Mrs. Washington hasn't yet arrived in New York City to take her place at the president's side. Mrs. Adams isn't here yet either, and Mrs. Knox has grown too fleshy to delight in dancing anymore. Still, I was scarcely in any position to replace any of those ladies. No one will look to me. I'm just the wife of a New York assemblyman. At this, Angelica let out a sudden howl of laughter.
You dare not let Hamilton hear you diminish his stature in such a way. His pride couldn't let the insult stand. You're the wife of the mastermind who brought this presidency into being, and everyone knows it.
That was true enough. I glowed with pride at my husband's accomplishments, but I didn't wish to indulge my own vanity.
And who knows what he'll go on to do next? Angelica gushed.
I had an inkling that Alexander was considering a cabinet position, though he hadn't shared more than the idea that it was a possibility. Selfishly, perhaps, some part of me hoped he could be content with his private law practice. For public life came with endless outrages. There had been, only recently, a poisonous screed in the papers imputing all manner of villainy to my husband, including infidelity to our marriage bed.
He will not be bound by even the most solemn of all obligations, wedlock.
I thought it an absurd accusation, for even if my husband were a sinful sort of man, where would he find time to betray me? Some days, the man barely slept nor found time to sit for a meal, let alone spend time with his children. Angelica came to sit beside me. You know, don't you? Well, tell me. What position is he being offered? I don't know, I said, the words uncomfortable on my tongue. For why didn't I know? Only that he's being considered for the cabinet. I'm not surprised. Washington might be president, but like a king, he'll need a prime minister. And who else would it be but Hamilton? Of course, she was right. But tonight, I wish to focus on the celebration, not the reality of governance and the challenges such an appointment would represent for us. Then that's even more reason why you must join us at the inaugural ball, I managed. And I won't take no for an answer. Angelica squeezed my hand and winked. Now that sounded like the commanding voice of a prime minister's wife. That evening, I dressed in a dark blue gown with painted flowers I'd commissioned specially for the occasion, and we wedged ourselves into Angelica's hired gilded coach for the short ride down Broadway to the assembly rooms. My sister believed a man of my husband's stature needed to arrive in a grand fashion, and she was probably right. But my mind was unsettled about Alexander's intentions for our future, and the way my powdered hair, styled very tall, bumped the carriage rooftop with every jolt of the wheels didn't help. By contrast, Angelica seemed at ease, and woefully underdressed. She insisted it was now quite the fashion on the continent to go with natural hair, wearing the simpler gown she claimed had been popularized by the Queen of France. And everyone was very interested in all things French that summer, since the king had, at Lafayette's instigation, called together the Estates General to reform France's government in accordance with the principles of liberty. Heaving a dreamy sigh, Angelica told us, Mr. Jefferson believes that our revolution has unchained the mind of man, and that the whole world is now making itself over. She spoke often, and recklessly, of her flirtation with Mr. Jefferson, boasting to all who would listen how tall he was, how learned and courtly,
What a wonderful father he was to his little motherless daughters. Even confiding to us the man's secret dalliances. Exasperated, Alexander teased that she'd perhaps formed an improper attachment to the man. I feared she might take it as a rebuke. But instead, Angelica seemed delighted by the suggestion of jealousy in his voice. Oh, but who can know what is proper anymore? My sister was not the only one to wonder it, as 300 well-coiffed guests all jockeyed for position in the entryway of the festooned ballroom. With Mrs. Washington absent, ladies of rank had donned their most exquisite gowns, flashed their jewels, and flaunted their connections to contend for influence and position in this brave new society. Ordinarily, Governor Clinton's wife would have been next in line to set the tone and protocol for the event. But the formidable Mrs. Knox, wife of the new Secretary of War, seemed to believe the honor was hers. Mrs. Knox had been the one to buy the brown cloth for the president's inaugural suit. All of American manufacture. Mrs. Knox was the one who hosted the party after the president was sworn in, where we watched firecrackers explode in bright, glittering display over the Hudson River. And Mrs. Knox was the one to have insisted upon commemorative gifts, ivory fans, imported from France, each depicting a medallion portrait of Washington in profile between the hinges and elegant paper covering. So I was happy to let her have her due, especially at the expense of a Clinton.
Oh, how marvelous,
Peggy murmured as she joined us, fluttering her eyelashes behind the fan.
A keepsake to treasure.
I used mine to wave across the room. Mr. Madison! As always, Madison wore black, leading me to worry that the poor bachelor owned just the one suit. His eyes kept darting to the entryway, as if he were reconsidering having come at all, ill at ease in society as he always seemed to be. And seeing him fidget as I waved to him, Angelica's eyes widened. Oh, my. Tell me that pale little creature isn't the exalted Mr. Madison that I've heard you talk so much about.
Be kind, I whispered. He's very clever, but very shy.
Peggy made a face behind her fan. He looks like some sort of incorruptible parson. Which made my husband laugh. A rather apt comparison. That he is uncorrupted and incorruptible, I have not a doubt. At last, the bookish congressman made his way through the press and offered a bow. Clapping Madison on the back with enough force to make him cough, Hamilton introduced his brilliant colleague to my sisters. And the mere sight of Angelica seemed to force Jemmy to retrieve a kerchief from his velvet coat with which to wipe sweat from his brow. Congratulations upon your recent election to Congress, Mr. Madison, I said.
Hopefully condolences aren't in order, he quipped. How are my favorite little Hamiltons?
That he always remembered our brood of children so tenderly made me ever fonder of him. Philip can hold whole conversations in French with Alexander and Angelica. I'm quite left out. While Jimmy and I chattered, Peggy sighed impatiently.
Is there no formal order to this reception?
Angelica's gaze searched the room. I'm told the president's levees are very formal. Are we to be announced, or curtsy as in a royal court?
Madison cringed. I'm afraid we're in a wilderness without a single footstep to guide us. And here we are setting an example for the whole world.
The whole world. I gulped to think that might not be an exaggeration.
After all, no one seemed to know what should be proper in a republic. We were all grasping for ways to behave. When the president first arrived in the city, he'd been mobbed with well-wishers, job-seekers, former soldiers, and gawkers of all classes and variety. Now people, if well-dressed, were allowed into his mansion on Fridays. Out of respect for his own majesty, when the president went out, he did so in a richly appointed buff carriage, pulled by 6 gleaming white horses and 2 drivers in presidential livery. but he also made a point of taking a walk every day at 2 o'clock, to see and be seen on the streets, which, though cleaner since the war, still echoed with the noise of rattling carts, roaming livestock, and merchants hawking their wares. We weren't even sure what to call the president. Mr. Adams, in what my husband called a fit of madness, had suggested, "His Highness, the President of the United States and Protector of their Liberties." That had been roundly condemned as having the foul stench of monarchy about it. And perhaps because the Anti-Federalists dared not criticize George Washington, they turned their merciless venom on Vice President Adams, addressing him as "His Rotundity" and "the Duke of Braintree." Just then, the hall broke into applause when Washington appeared at the front of the room, Adams standing beside him. Before a backdrop of gold stars upon a blue field, the president offered the shortest of possible welcomes, as if he were embarrassed by the attention, then gave a nod that bade the musicians to play. With the majority of revelers looking on, Washington led a minuet. Alexander turned to me, holding out his hand. "Shall we?" Finding Angelica and Peggy in animated conversation, I readily accepted, and soon we were moving through the formations. The crowd and low-hanging crystal chandeliers quickly heated the room, and the wax was still warm when it dripped down onto our shoulders from the candles. And I became acutely aware of the envious stares of ladies, all of whom, it seemed, wished to dance with my handsome husband. They whispered behind their fans, tittered when he came near, and one of his young female admirers was so entranced that she did not notice that one of the chandeliers had set fire to her ornate ostrich feather headdress until one of the president's aides clapped the feathers in his hands to rescue her. "Ask Angelica to dance next," I said to my husband when our set came to an end. He kissed my hand. "As you wish." I'd no more than sipped at a cup of punch when President Washington appeared beside me. "Mrs. Hamilton," he said, his tone formal as ever.
"Good evening, Your Excellency, and congratulations."
"May I have the pleasure of this dance?" Washington asked with a little nod.
"A most brilliant entertainment indeed. Oh, it would be an honor." The president pulled me into the center of the dance floor and guided us through the figures of the minuet with his characteristic dignity and grace. And all the while, I felt the weight of hundreds of gazes. Congressmen, cabinet officers, foreign ministers, and those of their wives and daughters. And my conversation with Angelica came rushing back. Had President Washington singled me out because he intended to make my husband one of his cabinet officers? The thought caused me less anxiety than it had before, for knowing that Washington and his lady were leaving behind their beloved home at Mount Vernon to serve this country again, I could hardly argue that Alexander and I shouldn't reconcile ourselves to a lesser sacrifice. When the music ended, the president bowed and I beamed, especially as my sisters ran up to exclaim over the mark of respect he'd paid me. "Mrs. Prime Minister," Angelica whispered, probably too loudly, considering that we were suddenly encircled by ladies with whom I had only the most sparing acquaintance, except for my old friend Kitty Livingston. Though we hadn't often spent time together since Morristown, I was pleased to see her now. "Kitty," I cried, at first surprised that she'd come to town for a visit without telling me. Then, altogether startled when she turned her back, as if I were a stranger. "Kitty, have we been so busy with our lives you've forgotten us?" All at once, Kitty whirled upon me in a swirl of pink-striped satin, eyes burning with anger. "I haven't forgotten anything, unlike your husband, who forgets who helped him get his start in this country. My family introduced him into society, but I suppose he has new friends now."
"How appallingly rude," Peggy spat at Kitty.
Kitty turned on her.
Rude? And yet you were the one jesting loud enough for everyone to hear that Mrs. Church would like Hamilton to become a knight of her bedchamber. Peggy's mouth dropped into an oval. I never said any such thing. Meanwhile, my cheeks heated at the insult of being confronted this way in public. Kitty, I don't know what you mean by any of this. Pay her no mind, Peggy said, linking our arms and attempting to pull me away. Yes, you do know what I mean, Kitty accused, placing herself in our way. Even more malevolently, she added, Then again, you've always made it your business to remain unaware of anything you didn't wish to be aware of, Betsy. So let me explain. Your father, who is certain to get a Senate appointment, promised that your family would support my cousin for the other Senate seat. But now that Hamilton is to command the nation's treasury, he's violated the agreement and thrown his weight behind some upstart. With a rustle of her skirts, Angelica interposed herself between us like my guardsman. Oh, but Kitty, you'll put a wrinkle in your forehead worrying about politics. Let the man sort it out while you tell me where you found this divine pink robe. Never before in our whole lives had my older sister been content to leave politics to the men. In fact, Angelica was, in her own dulcet way, performing a political act by trying to divert the conversation. And striking as that was, what most stood out to me was Kitty's certainty that Alexander was to be appointed treasurer. How did she know that when I did not? Kitty was not distracted by my sister's diversionary talk of fashion. As always, you Schuylers stick together. But remember, so do the Livingstons. With that, Kitty flounced away. She must have misunderstood something, I murmured, my head spinning as I turned to Peggy. What was she on about anyway? Angelica gave a wave of her fan. Much ado about nothing. I dropped a garter during the dance, and Alexander gallantly swept it up and returned it to me. So of course I teased that in America he can't be a knight of the garter. She grasped me by the shoulders. Pay Kitty Livingston no mind. With power and influence comes jealousy, Betsy. Yes, Peggy said quickly. Don't let her upset you. I won't, I said. On any other night, I might have fretted about the confrontation, but I refused to do so on this night. Not when we'd worked so hard to get here, and not when I wished to cheer Angelica, and certainly not after President Washington had done me such an honor. Peggy sighed, and I followed her glance in the direction of Governor Clinton. But your husband does have a penchant for making powerful enemies. He has to, Angelica replied. It's the way of the world. You can't rise in station without something or someone to step on. With Papa now in the Senate, and Hamilton possibly leading the new Treasury Department, our family is in ascendance. The Livingstons will simply have to learn to cede to their betters.
Mrs. Hamilton,
my husband purred against my neck.
You were tonight, as you were in Morristown all those years ago, the belle of the ball.
I peered at him in the mirror of my dressing table, where I sat removing my pearl ear bobs. Despite the unpleasantness with Kitty, the ball had been thrilling, and I was both exhausted and exhilarated. The grandness of the occasion, my husband's unfailing attention, the liveliness of the society, and the dance with our country's new president. It had all been a delight. We deserved this celebration, this moment, this joy. The belle of the ball. Is that so, Colonel Hamilton? I asked coyly. His very warm hands moved my embroidered stomacher.
It is.
I sighed. And yet, when the rooster crows, the children will awaken, and I shall be transformed into a simple Dutch housewife once again.
Then I'll make good use of the hours between now and the rooster, he said,
playfully pulling a pin from the fabric and carelessly letting it drop upon the mahogany table with a soft plink.
Alexander.
I shifted toward him, my blood heating with the feel of his breath on my nape. Fleetingly, I worried about the possibility of conceiving another babe when I already had an orphaned Fanny and four of our own little ruffians underfoot, all so close in age. And yet the erotic edge in his voice and the scent of brandy on his breath made it impossible to resist. "Careful," he said, plucking another sharp pin. "Except for that first rapturous instance upon our nuptials, I would not wish our trysts to be blood sport." He dragged the point of the pin harmlessly over my bodice. I felt quite at the mercy of his sweet assault, in a way that made me feel more lover than wife. One pin led to another, and before long the whole gown was in pieces at my feet, and my husband's touch drove away all my worries. Afterward, Hamilton held me in his arms in the quiet dark of our bed. "The president wishes to appoint me Secretary of the Treasury."
So, there it was. Finally.
I swallowed as competing reactions fought to be voiced. I was proud, of course, but also worried about how we could manage as his duties became more demanding. As it was, he was so often gone, leaving me almost always alone to bear the heavy burden of our domestic responsibilities. Not just the children, but also our occasionally insufficient means. But even more, and perhaps ridiculously, I nursed a little ache that he was only now telling me something others already knew. Going back to our little shack at DePaster's Point, he'd always brought me into his work. I'd helped him in the writing and publishing of The Federalist. So I suppose I'd taken the liberty of thinking that we were partners in the enterprise of his career.
"That's a great honor, husband,"
I managed.
Am I the last to know?"
Alexander blew out a breath and pulled my back to his chest.
"I didn't wish to concern you with it until the details were confirmed, and now they are."
So it was decided, then.
It was a decision that would determine my future and the happiness of my family, but I wasn't consulted as a partner would be. I was told, and it made me feel childish and naive and small, not like the Prime Minister's wife, which I was to be, after all.
"I should like to have known you were considering it,"
I murmured, knowing Robert Livingston also wanted that job, and if it went to my husband, it would create an even deeper rift between our families.
"You know why,"
Alexander said, frustration causing his voice to rise.
"I brought this government into being, and I'm now obligated to put the machine into some regular motion."
It didn't escape my notice that he hadn't actually responded to what I'd said, and that turned my hurt to resentment.
"May I ask the salary?"
"I predict about $3,500.
It was so far below our already stretched income that I feared to take a breath. Perhaps sensing my panic, he said,
"It's a financial sacrifice, I know."
"No, I don't think you do know."
I'd kept the burden of that knowledge from him, well aware of how he resented dependency. So while he went about accepting payments from clients in barrels of ham and sending money to his ungrateful and dubious relations in the West Indies, I'd made certain that he didn't know about the loans from Papa or the extra shipments of food from Mama. Dinner came to his table on plates given to me by my sisters, and he never asked how it got there. Alexander didn't know how I patched clothes for one child to pass down to another, how I stretched our stores of root vegetables from season to season, or how I traded homemade preserves and table mats in exchange for wine to serve important guests. He turned to face me, and his eyes were an ocean storm.
"Before we married, madam, I asked you countless times if you could be happy."
"As a poor man's wife, yes.
and have I or the children once complained? That is not my concern, Alexander,
I said, my heart aching that he would question my loyalty. Then what is? But he didn't allow me to answer before sitting up and charging on. I've shed blood, Elizabeth.
Though he burned hot, he wasn't often a man to shout. But the moment I mentioned the little ones, something seemed to have snapped in him, as if he felt I'd impugned his honor as a father.
I've killed men in the cause of this country, and how shall I answer my children, or God, for that matter, if it should all be for nothing?
God? That he, who had only reluctantly consented to baptize our children at Trinity Church, should fling salvation at me? You are not the only man who shed blood in the cause of this country, I wanted to say.
And having been forced so often to listen to chatter about forms of government, I knew the point of a republic was that nothing should rest entirely upon one man.
Surely the whole enterprise would not fall to pieces simply because 34-year-old Alexander Hamilton did not have command of its accounting books. But I didn't say any of this, for fear he would bury me in an avalanche of arguments. Instead, I kept quiet, and what he mistook for submission seemed to ease him. Heaving a breath, he pulled me to him again.
My angel, the treasury is where I can do most good for the country, and this consideration must outweigh every consideration of a private nature.
It was a reminder that I was a general's daughter, a colonel's wife, that ours was a family that had led soldiers in the cause of the country and must see it through troubled times to safety. Perhaps I was more saint-like than I'd wanted to admit, because I found myself softening to the one approach that had the power to cut through my anger, patriotism. Moreover, I knew what a godly woman would do, a saint-like woman. She'd resign herself to the will of her husband and master, and devote herself with resignation to his decree. Besides, if Church could stop loving Angelica, who was so charming and agreeable that she'd fascinated royalty, how easy might it be for Hamilton to stop loving me? Suddenly, the hurt I felt that he hadn't consulted me felt petty, so I didn't give voice to it. Not when I wished to right the wrong I'd caused between us. I gave a little nod.
Of course, Alexander. I understand.
His expression softened, and he fastened those irresistible eyes on me.
This position is what I've been hoping for, planning for, all along.
And all at once I knew it was true. All those treatises on economic policy, all the late-night conversations with Papa and the powerful financiers of New York, all the books on economic systems— all those times Hamilton had gone off to war or to Philadelphia and left me alone for months on end, or even when he was so absorbed in his work that he didn't look up for days. I'd been planning our domestic life together, but he'd been planning this. And it made me realize I still had so much to learn about my husband's ambitions.
Chapter 20 June 1789, New York City.
Welcome to the menagerie, I said to James Madison, as a cacophony of our chickens squawked in their pen in the yard. There were advantages to living across the street from the busy federal building. For example, when my husband left the house to attend business there, he wasn't far. But it was also too easy for him to return home with colleagues. One hot summer afternoon, when my daughter was shrieking at the top of the stairs because one of her brothers had taken her ribbon, I was obliged to receive Mr. Madison. As I wrangled the children, he glanced out the back door, propped open to permit a cooling breeze, and asked,
"Is that?"
"The neighbor's monkey," my husband answered, with more gravity than I would have expected.
He led his friend into the yard for the shade of a tree.
"It keeps climbing over the fence to taunt the chickens."
I watch the men settle themselves, fretting over Alexander's pensiveness. And I took them some lemonade. Is anything the matter? The men exchanged a glance that made my stomach